It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter pledged on Sunday a full and transparent investigation of the airstrike at a hospital in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz that left at least 22 people dead. That happened on Saturday. U.S. military acknowledged it conducted an airstrike in the vicinity of an MSF hospital. That bombing triggered a firestorm of criticism from aid groups, including the international medical charity Doctors Without Borders, which operated the medical facility in Kunduz. Indiana University South Asia expert Nazif Sirani tells VOA the loss of the hospital will leave the locals without much medical treatment.
It is a tragedy, like many other tragedies of the war in Afghanistan. It's unfortunate, and I think what AP is describing is absolutely correct. This was a major hospital for the kinds of war injuries that is common in the area, and it did cover the whole of the north northeast of Afghanistan. So in that respect, it is a real problem, I think, for those who are alive.
Afghan troops backed by U.S. airstrikes have been engaged in heavy fighting in and around Kunduz against Taliban militants who took over the city early last week. Militants claiming loyalty to the Islamic State say they were behind two late Friday explosions in suburbs of the Nigerian capital Abuja that killed 15 people, wounded dozens of others. The Nigerian militant group Boko Haram has carried out similar attacks in the past. This is VOA News. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said Sunday that the whole Middle East would be destroyed if Russia's aerial bombardment of militants opposed to his government does not succeed. Assad's comments came as Russia intensified its airstrikes against the insurgents. Moscow announced that it carried out 20 missions targeting 10 Islamic State training camps, army depots, and American command posts, that is, in the past day in Idlib province. U.S., however, accuses Russia of seeking to support Assad by targeting Western-backed opponents of his government instead of Islamic State fighters that a U.S. coalition has been bombing for more than a year. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced tough new measures against Palestinian extremists, declaring that his country is in a war to the death against terrorism. Prime Minister said demolitions of terrorist homes will be speeded up, security forces in Jerusalem and the West Bank will be bolstered, and jailing of suspected terrorists without trial will be expanded. Israeli police also have imposed new security restrictions on Palestinians in Jerusalem, temporarily barring those who live outside the old city from entering it. Palestinian lawmaker Hanan Hashraoui accused the Israeli government of denying Palestinians a right to travel freely within what she called a Palestinian city.
They are also allowing and protecting the settlers to attack Palestinians everywhere. The settlers are on the rampage. The extremists are dictating the agenda, the Israeli extremists. And of course, this government is creating a situation of extreme volatility and violence.
Israeli security measures coincide with the final days of two Jewish holiday festivals. Death toll from last week's massive landslide on the outskirts of Guatemala's capital has now risen to 131. Officials say young children and newborn babies were included in the toll. Landslide struck a village about 15 kilometers east of the capital, Guatemala City. A typhoon made landfall in southern China on Sunday afternoon, killing at least four, causing tens of thousands to evacuate coastal areas. The storm had winds up to 180 kilometers per hour when it came ashore in southern Guangdong province. And torrential rains have pounded the French Riviera. That happened over the weekend, dumping nearly 18 centimeters of rain in 3 hours on the Mediterranean coastline and turning it, they say, into a sea of mud. Authorities say at least 17 people were killed. You can get more news at our website. That's voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today's Monday, October 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebels say President Salva Kiir's creation of 28 new states violates the recent peace agreement.
This is a violation of the agreement that we have signed on the 17th and the 26th, because the agreement is clearly stating 10 states. And if you are amending or changing any article or any clause in the agreement, it has to be agreed upon by the parties.
Ezekiel Lo Galkuov is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLA in opposition. Liberia's foreign minister resigns. We'll get analysis. Election-related violence in Guinea-Conakry as the country prepares for the October election. And over 30,000 South African coal miners went on strike on Sunday.
We have urged the employers to at least give a 1,000 rand wage increase to those categories, as their white counterparts who are in higher categories are getting between 1,500 and 2,000 rand. The employers have not met that demand.
Peter Bailey is chief negotiator in the coal sector of the National Union of Mine Workers of South Africa. African agricultural experts promote non-traditional food species, and hybrid seeds and fertilizer are found to be poor in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar say President Salva Kiir's decision to establish 28 new states is a violation of the recently signed peace agreement and indicates he is not committed to peace. A statement issued over the weekend and signed by Mr. Machar called for the Regional Group Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGA, which mediated the peace process, to take a position. In a decree establishing the 28 new states, President Salva Kiir said his decision was guided by South Sudan's transitional constitution. He also said the purpose of the new states was to decentralize power and resources closer to the rural population. Ambassador Ezekiel Lo Galkuov is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLA in opposition. He said President Kiir took a unilateral decision based purely on tribal consideration.
This is a violation of the agreement that we have signed on the 17th and the 26th, because the agreement is clearly stating 10 states. And if you are amending or changing any article or any clause in the agreement, it has to be agreed upon by the parties. So it is a clear violation of this agreement. SALFA has no right to create 28 states. We should be focusing on implementing the agreement, not violating it, because this is actually a violation of the agreement. It is actually not in the spirit of the agreement that we have signed. So we are actually calling on SALFA himself to withdraw this order, because it is not in conformity with the agreement. Second to that, the attempt by the president to divide South Sudan into 28 states, it is actually going to add more confusion to the people of South Sudan.
President Salva Kiir had said that your organization, your leader, Riek Machar, had proposed the creation of new states. So he said what he did is in line with South Sudan's transitional constitution.
Well, yes, this has been our demand. We have a vision that is calling for a federal system, more counties, more states. This has been what we wanted to see happening. But now, since the agreement is signed and the agreement is restricting the two parties only to the 10 states, you cannot change it all of a sudden into, say, 28 states.
So have you lodged a complaint with IGA? As you know, IGA has been mediating the whole peace process. What are they saying?
Well, my chairman, Dr. Riek Machar Teng, who is also the first vice president designate, wrote a press statement telling the world that this is unacceptable. It should be condemned because it is going to derail the peace process, the implementation of the peace process. So we have launched publicly a complaint to the public and to the people of South Sudan. And Dr. Machar also is talking to the regional leaders like IGAD, that this is not in line with the agreement that we have signed. All of them, they are actually seeing the point, and I'm sure they will be asking for Salva to withdraw.
Does your organization believe the creation of these new states is based on purely decentralizing the Sudan government, because that's what the president said? Or do you think this is based on purely tribal grounds?
Well, you know what we have done in our policy? We have decided to name 21 states based on the colonial border districts. so that it actually really clearly stating that so-and-so belongs to who, so-and-so belongs to who. The way President Salva did it is actually more ethnicized, more confusion. So definitely he's going to have serious difficulties and challenges. No one man can just decide all of a sudden, I want to create 28 states.
Ambassador Ezekiel Lo-Gatkuof is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the SPLA in opposition. He was speaking with me from Omaha, Nebraska. In South Africa, more than 30,000 coal miners of the National Union of Mine Workers began an indefinite strike on Sunday after wage negotiations broke down. South Africa's coal industry is believed to employ about 90,000 people and produces the bulk of the country's electricity. Peter Bailey, chief negotiator in the coal sector of the union, says the miners had no alternative but to go on strike because the employers failed to meet the workers' demand.
We're on strike because the salary, the wage negotiations has collapsed and the employers have not met the demand of the workers. And after conciliation by the Commissioner for Mediation and Arbitration, he has then issued a certificate of unresolved. And as a result of that, we then gave 48-hour notice of intent to embark on industrial action.
You said the wage talks have collapsed. What exactly are you demanding?
Well, the employers have offered between 5.5% and 8.5% for categories 4 to 8, which is the lowest paid workers in the mining sector. And which are members of the National Union of Mine Workers. We have urged the employers to at least give a 1,000 rand wage increase to those categories, as their white counterparts who are in higher categories are getting between 1,500 and 2,000 rand. The employers have not met that demand, and therefore the workers have then given us a mandate to embark on industrial action.
Coal is very important in South Africa because of electricity. Are you not concerned you might disrupt this very important commodity?
Yes, it is an important commodity, but the employers give themselves as executive and directors exorbitant salary increases and bonuses at the expense of the lowest paid. And therefore the question that is directed to us now, that is actually a fair question to direct to the employers.
So you want the wages to increase by up to what, 8.5 or what?
No, the 1,000 rand constitutes about 13% wage increase. And you must remember that 13% wage increase, the 5.5% to 8.5%, constitutes 357 rand and 600 and something rand for other categories, while their white counterparts are getting 1,500 to 2,000 rand per month wage increase. We believe that that is an unfair practice. We believe that the wage gap between black and white is too huge, and this would further advance the wage gap between black and white. And therefore, we are not going to succumb to the pressure that the commodity is going to cripple the country.
In reality, you want this wage increase to match the inflation rate in South Africa?
No, no, no. This is not an inflation rate increase. This is about a rand value increase, because the inflation rate increase is a misrepresentation of the fact. And therefore, our members have then urged us not to go for inflationary increases, because as they go, even when the commodity prices are booming, even when the mining industry makes a killing, the offer on the table is inflation-linked for workers who sacrifice their lives, limbs and lungs to the brutality of the industry. But when it comes to executives and CEOs, there is no limitation to what they are given.
Peter Bailey is chief negotiator in the coal sector of the National Union of Mine Workers of South Africa. He was speaking with me from Johannesburg. Today is Monday, October 5th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. At least one person was killed and more than 20 wounded in election-related violence in southeastern Guinea over the weekend. Clashes broke out when President Alpha Condé, who is seeking re-election in the October poll, visited Nzarikori, and his supporters asked shopkeepers to close their stores. Vincent Foucher, Guinea researcher of the International Crisis Group, tells Ricky Stryer this is the first time someone has been killed in campaign-related violence for the upcoming October 11 presidential election.
I was told of 80 people wounded and at least one person killed.
As I understand it, it's tensions between more of the Fulani and then Alpha Conde's supporters.
I'm told that Alpha Conde supporters basically wanted people to shut down shops on the day of the Alpha Conde meeting in Zakoi. So the Peul particularly were not really keen on doing that. And so apparently there were incidents and some shops were attacked and looted and so on. And so there were fights.
But the fighting has basically stopped now. It was mainly over the weekend, correct?
Yes, that's what I've heard. Yeah, yeah. I'm told the number of people sought refuge with the security forces. I would say probably Fulani shopkeepers and their family. Probably some of them may have tried to find refuge with because they are a very tiny minority in Zakoi.
And so far, this has just been an isolated event in Zakoi, correct? It hasn't spread anywhere else?
Well, I mean, there have been a few such incidents in other parts of Guinea since the beginning of the campaign. There was one in Kundahar, there was one incident in Mamou, but it doesn't seem, you know, each time a number of people have been wounded, that Zakoi incident, if indeed someone was killed, and we still need to wait, that will be the first time someone is killed in this campaign.
And the Fulani are traditionally more loyal to opposition candidate Selu Dilanjalo. So, you know, obviously that probably aggravated the situation.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the one of the problems with Guinea is that politics is infused with ethnicity through and through. And basically each of the two big candidates is basically strongly entrenched in one in his community. And so people are, you know, jumping to conclusions. If you're a Peul, you're suspected to be pro-opposition, and if you're a Malinke, you're suspected of being pro-government. You know, that's very basic.
Since the elections are coming up soon on October 11th, what is kind of the situation on the ground? Where could there be tensions? Where could there be violence? Or does it look like the security forces have it under control? Because I know there have been reforms lately in the last few years.
There's a tradition of campaign violence in Guinea. It's been seen before, so it's not very surprising what's happening. You know, the time of the campaign is the moment when you've got excited militants who are very motivated. Some of them are getting money from the party. Others are just, you know, excited about standing up for their party, and people meet. And so there are so many occasions for violence. I would say it's rather normal. But then the problem with Guinea is that sometimes an incident can escalate and there can be reprisals elsewhere. And you know, that's always a risk. You know, even if only a few people are wounded every time, because politics is so ethnic, it might find echoes in other areas as well, where some people might say, well, we're going to defend ourselves, we're going to take revenge, or, you know, whatever. And so it could escalate. It doesn't have to. It's just a possibility.
That was Vincent Foucher, Guinea researcher for the International Crisis Group. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Liberian Foreign Minister Augustin Gafouan has resigned, saying he wants to be an active player in the coming 2017 presidential and general elections. He served the Ellen Johnson Sirleaf government for 10 unbroken years in various capacities. In a statement issued over the weekend, Gafouan said there was no acrimonious relationship between him and the president. Contacted by VOA, Mr. Gafouan declined to give voice interview. Rodney Sear is publisher of Liberia's front page African newspaper and online magazine. He said Foreign Minister Gafouan also took aim at the legislative act requiring all officials appointed by the president and who are desirous of seeking an elector office to resign their positions 2 years before the date of the election.
The minister, in a statement issued late Saturday evening, said that he took keen note of the provision of the Act of Legislature prescribing a national code of conduct for all public officials, basically saying that they should resign before they participate in political office for 2017 elections. And he said that he wanted, for example, to step aside because he has some ambitions for 2017, as he puts it. He's not going to be on the sidelines, and he tends to be a big player in 2017 elections.
If that is the case, does that mean that he could challenge Vice President Joseph Boakai for the leadership of the ruling Unity Party?
Yeah, that's the most complicating debate that's developing for the ruling Unity Party, because Vice President Joe Boakai belongs to that party, and he's the President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's running mate in two elections. And Mr. Gafouan has served in the Sirleaf administration since the early days of the government, first as budget director, then finance minister, and now foreign affairs minister. He's the first fighter from the Salit camp to actually contest or now contending for an office in 2017 or going to be a player in this election. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out because Wakar comes from Lofa County, where the minister also comes from.
Rodney, I read the foreign minister's statement, and also I did talk with him for some time. And it seems to me that he's very unhappy about this act of the legislature governing the code of conduct for cabinet ministers or public officials or appointed public officials, which he believes is intended to deprive cabinet members and other political appointees the opportunity to pursue their political ambition.
Yeah, the act clearly states that any minister, deputy minister, director general, national director, superintendent appointed by the president, pursuant to Article 56 of the Constitution, and the managing director appointed by the board of directors who desires to contest for public office shall resign the post 2 years prior to the debate. And that date, James, comes October 15 this year. So that means by October 15, if nobody follows Gafuan into resigning, it might be a problem because there are a lot of people names out there who are in the air about contesting 2017. And now that the minister has set the pace for the 2017 elections, resigning and announcing that he's going to be a contender or some player, it needs to be seen how the other contenders, potential contenders, will fare, whether they will resign. For example, we're hearing that the central bank governor, Nils Jones, is one of those being eyed. He's still in the position at central bank. There are other people whose names have come up. We haven't heard them resigning, but now that the Kafuan has come out and said he's resigning because of this code of conduct, it's going to set the precedent for others to follow. Whether they will implement it remains to be seen.
Rodney Sears, the publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper and online magazine. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Researchers say they have found evidence to help explain why farmers in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo are not adopting new agricultural technologies. Two recent studies found that samples of so-called improved seeds and fertilizer being marketed or distributed in the region were of low quality and hardly worth buying. Nick Long has more from Kisoro in Uganda.
In most parts of the world, crop yields have increased by between 3 and 5 times in the past 40 years, but in sub-Saharan Africa, they have stagnated. Technologies such as chemical fertilizer and hybrid seeds seem to have worked wonders elsewhere. Why haven't they produced a green revolution in Africa? Researchers at Harvard and Stockholm universities did field trials in Uganda on fertilizer bought from local markets and from producers. They also tested 3 types of seed: hybrid seed bought from producers or from local retailers, and ordinary seed farmers keep over from the harvest. They found the fertilizer and seed from retailers was poor quality, says one of the researchers, Tessa Bold.
We found that about 30% of nutrient is missing in fertilizers, and that if you buy hybrid seeds from a retailer, they're about as good in terms of yields as if you were mixing 50% farmer seeds and about 50% of properly authentic hybrid seeds.
She says hybrid seeds and fertilizers bought in local markets are not really worth buying.
We really do not know why the quality is lower. Anecdotally, people talk about, you know, adulteration. People like take little stones and paint them to look like seed, or they just pour in some farmer seeds and sort of mix them up like that.
VOA asked a retailer at an agro shop in Kisoro, Uganda, Mary Sebekari.
That one I cannot answer because myself I don't mix. Some of the seeds which we have, they come when they are packed. So there is no how you can mix a thing which is packed.
Another study in the DRC by researcher Walter Hager, who works for a Belgian development agency, found that so-called improved varieties of maize seed were no better than farmer seeds.
The improved seed, to my point of view, it's an ideology. Improved seed doesn't exist. You have to ask, what are you talking about? Are you talking about a variety that has a better performance? And if it has a better performance, where? Because varieties always have to be adapted to certain circumstances. Yes. In the context of Congo, nobody knows where this variety, this genetic, is really better than the local ones.
He added that seed storage practices in Congo are contributing to diminished performance. Nick Long for VOA News, Kisoro.
It's coming up about 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the Africa Women's Basketball Championships in Yaounde, Cameroon. Senegal outplayed Cameroon 81-66 to win the Africa Women's Basketball Championship on Saturday. Nigeria outwitted outgoing champions Angola 65-55 to claim the bronze medal. Mali pipped Mozambique 69-68 to place fifth. Gabon edged Egypt 71-67 to place seventh. Guinea pipped Uganda 53-52 to place ninth. And Algeria outplayed South Africa 87-49 to place 11th. Consequently, Senegal clinched the automatic ticket to the women's basketball contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Cameroon and Nigeria get a last chance to qualify for the Olympics at a 12-nation playoff next June, where the top five will proceed to Rio de Janeiro. Turning to football, hosts South Africa and Equatorial Guinea play to a scoreless draw in the opening leg of their women's 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic football qualifier in Johannesburg, while Cameroon edged visitors Zimbabwe 2-1 in Yaounde on Saturday. Meanwhile, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe beat Sudanese visitors Elmerek 3-0 in the return leg of their Orange Africa Champions League semi-final in Lubumbashi on Sunday. TP Mazembe prevailed on a 4-2 aggregate. Earlier on Saturday, Algerian hosts USM Algiers and Sudanese guests El Hilal drew 0-0 in Algiers. USM Algiers advanced to the final courtesy of a 2-1 aggregate. Elsewhere, South Africa's Orlando Pirates bounced back from a 2-0 deficit to edge Egyptian hosts and defending champions Al Ahly 4-3 in the return leg of their Orange Africa Confederations Cup semi-final in Cairo on Sunday. Orlando Pirates win the tie on a 5-3 aggregate. Early on Saturday, Egypt's Zamalek outclassed Tunisian visitors Etoile du Sahel 3-0 in Cairo. However, it was not enough to eliminate the Tunisian side, who proceed to the final on a 5-4 aggregate. Finally, South Africa beat Scotland 34-16 at the Rugby World Cup in London, England on Saturday. With one match left to conclude their preliminary round fixtures, South Africa topped Group B with 11 points. Scotland has 10, Japan 8, Samoa 4, and the United States of America has yet to secure a point. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, October 5th.
At the age of 55, Nigeria have done very well comparable to other countries that got independence before her. We are the largest economy in Africa and many more other achievements. I assure Nigerians at the age of 100, Nigeria would have gone very far. The only problem we have today that President Muhammadu Buhari must have to look at is the high rate of unemployment and high rate of life expectancy, as well as a plenty power supply. Albert Olagbo from Akanibia Federal Polytechnic in Ebonyi State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A suspected Islamic extremist in southeastern Niger detonated his explosives when confronted by a policeman on Sunday morning, killing the officer and wounding civilians in a town targeted numerous times by jihadists this year. That is it for this Monday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali. We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa. Next on Let's Talk, Turncoat.
According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing Turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.